This is a Pinball News production.
Thank you very much. I'm going to throw my picture up. There we go. Doesn't mean anything. I just happen to like it. Thank you all very much for coming and hearing me. I appreciate it. Thank you for coming in. Each person is appreciated. I was originally going to be leaving tonight, so I'm speaking on Friday, which is a little more difficult day. I like to have people when I talk, give me a microphone, I'm a happy person. I was going to the show in China, but the Chinese, the 18th Party Congress is taking place in October in Beijing, so the party asked the game people to postpone their show until December. So the good part of that is that I get to come here and spend a day longer than I had initially planned to, and so that's fine. I can play some more games. I see there's a meteor out there. There's actually two meteors out there. I'm digressing, but I tend to do that. Meteor was done by Steve Kirk, and it was at the old Stern, at Stern Electronics, and I had given my brother one of those, and he had it in the basement. And when we started this company, we needed to look at the drop target and some other things, so we brought it in to the company, and I gave it back to him in a body bag. He never really got a whole game back. He got pieces back. But it's a great game, so I enjoyed playing it. It was here. I have some brochures that you're all welcome to when I'm done, and we'll chat for a little bit. Michael, your director said, "Oh, do some history instead of your game philosophy and all that." How many of you have heard me speak before? Yeah, so you've all know my game philosophy stuff. Well, I'll do some of that, but you've all heard that before. So instead, we're going to, at 67, I'm 67. At 67, you'll find guys my age, we live a little bit in the past. We start thinking about who we knew when and reminisce and tell stories and think they're very important and everybody should be interested in them. But it is part of where all of this comes from, because I've been around this for a long time. And we'll talk about how I got here and, who else was involved in that. I've been around pinball, I say, for 65 years, because actually it was 1947 when my father bought part of Williams. What had happened, and some of you heard this story before. But let's do Sam. I got this. I'm in full control. I forgot. This is cool. Now, that's Sam. That's my father. So my father is, and actually here he looks like he has dark hair, but I think he was actually a blonde. I only knew him as gray. He always was gray like me whenever I knew him. So Sam, he had started, some of you have heard this, so I'm going to go through it fairly quickly. In the late 30s, he had a couple friends who were cops, and they said, Sam, you should get these games. They were the games like you have here, the countertop ones with the push shoot and all that and a couple pins. So Sam says, okay. So he goes and gets two of these games, and he puts them in a drugstore on the counter. And just like the cops said to do. So the next day he goes to check his games, and they're behind the counter. Somebody else's games are there. And the cop says, no, I didn't tell you to put them there. I told him you to put him over there. That's for those guys, You got to go over there. So, okay. Sam moves his games to the other location and sets them up. 10 o'clock that night, he gets a phone call. One of his games is broken. He says, that's it. I'm done with this business. I want nothing more to do with it. He runs down to fix the games. Now, again, these were push-shoot games, and the reason it was broken is the push-shoot wouldn't go in because there were so many coins in it that it wouldn't push anymore. So therefore, he decided game operating was a good business. He stayed with it. He used to take my mother on dates, and he'd stop by a spot. They were called spots, a bar, and collect the jukebox. And that's how he took her out. Now, my grandparents, my father was high school educated, I believe. He didn't go to college. My grandparents were, on his side, were immigrants. And my grandfather was, there's a merchant mentality. He was actually a junk dealer. He was senile, and he would still have his helper meet him. This was in Philadelphia. Meet him and pick up a the truck, and they'd go get a bunch of potato sacks here and sell them over there. And they were merchants. That's what they did. They bought and sold whatever they could. The only thing I really remember about them is they had a player piano that, this is a digression, it wasn't, they had a player piano that I used to play as a little kid. I used to drive it. It was my car, and I'd sit there and pump the pedals, and that's, you know, I thought I was driving a car. It wasn't too bright. And then they also, my grandmother let my brother and I paint the fence. So we had a bucket of water, and we sat there, and we painted the whole fence. It was sort of a reverse Tom Sawyer thing. Anyhow, so my father, you know, he started operating games, and in the development of this business, many operators became distributors. They became distributors to get games earlier and cheaper than their competitors got them. So he's an operator distributor, and in Philadelphia, his operating company was called Scott Cross. Just because one of his friends was in advertising, said, "What should I call the company?" And the friend said, "Scott Cross." "What's that?" "I don't know, but it sounded good." So that was the operating company. The other kind of, you know, you see game distributors or operator distributors, and you see game distributors that were distributor operators. The guys in the 30s who were operators became distributors, and they were operator distributors. Guys in the 70s and 80s, the video game boom, coin-op video game boom, was gigantic and then died. And so they had all this money out on the street where they had sold people games and hadn't been sold, hadn't been paid, so they took over the game routes, so they became distributor operators. So you see distributors in the coin-op business that also operate, and they either were operator distributors or distributor operators, if you get the gist of the difference there. So anyway, here's Sam in 1947, and that's when he goes to Chicago. He's a distributor, and he goes to Chicago, and he goes to see Harry Williams, his supplier, Williams Manufacturing Company. I'm in control of this. This is so unusual. That's Harry. That's Harry in 34. I believe it was 34 as a young man. And he had started operating games in L.A. He was from L.A., Los Angeles. And he started operating games there then did some game design of games. And he had a game, and on the tour they talked about it. He had a game called Contact, which was the first game with electricity in it. He had designed it. And in 1933... he went to the AMOA show, the MOA show. It wasn't the AMOA. It was Music Operators of America. The big business was jukeboxes. So he goes to the MOA show, and he meets Ray Maloney. Now, you'll hear some names. I'll just use a few names, a few people that were important to my understanding of this business. So Maloney, he was the head of Bally. And he also, as I understand from my father, was a great practical joker. You know, the bucket over the door, you know, when you opened it in his office, that type of thing. Actually pointing guns at people, which I don't think is much of a practical joke. You got to understand, these guys were all at little, these were young guys, and it was, you know, it wasn't the high-tech era today, youngguys.coms and stuff like that. But they all, you know, they lived, shall we say. And in any event, Harry, I guess, sold him a contact, and he, I guess Harry made it, and he made it at one point. But Harry went to work at Bally for a while. He was also at Rockola in charge of their game design at one point in time. And at Bally, he met a guy named Lynn Durant, which was another one of these young guys. And Harry and Lynn created a bond. They worked together. They designed together. Lynn was also an engineer. Lynn, I understand, used to... Harry had a Cord. I don't know if you know what a Cord car is, but it was a front-wheel drive car of the 30s, and the transmission was out on the front of it, and Harry was convinced there was something wrong with it, so Lynn would ride on the fender in the middle of winter and listen to the transmission so that he could sort out whatever was going on with Harry's car. so they ended up forming a company together, and were making games. And then in 42, Harry went and he started Williams. He started his own company. And Harry did well, in the 30s and in the 40s. He was doing well. That was the boat he had made for himself. Life was generally good. These guys, as they say, they were dapper guys. That's Harry. I think that's Kitschy, his daughter, with him, but I'm not sure. That might be one of his wives. Harry was married three times. He was close with the two ex-wives. He was married to Wanda, who he was married to when he died, and he was living in Palm Springs. The two wives, and he had one daughter, Kitschy. Kitschy also died. The two wives died on the same day. And I don't mean the same date, different years, the same day. It's just bizarre. But did. In any event, so Harry, the world was different. They lived an interesting life. Harry would go back and forth to California because he would be here to design. And he would live at the Edgewater Beach Hotel. The Edgewater Beach Apartments. And that's Harry, Lee, his wife, Kitschy, his daughter. And then that's Al and Ruth Stern, unrelated to me. It's another Stern. This is another Stern. They were Worldwide Distributing, which was a big distributor in Chicago. And I knew them only that Al and my father, Sam, used to take us to the circus, the kids to the circus together. So that's how I knew him. And then his sons, were involved in our business in various capacities later. Anyway, in 47, Sam, I'm back to 47, Sam comes into Chicago to see Harry, his supplier. He's a 35-year-old punk kid. I can say that because I'm 67, and now I can go backwards. Isn't this cool? Yeah, see, he was a young guy. I don't know what year that was, but he was a young guy. And Harry was a young guy. So Harry was a couple years older than Sam. Sam puts his feet up on Harry's desk, says, "Why don't you sell me the company?" And Harry says, "I'm going to have to think about that." And he goes and flies around Chicago for 3 hours, comes down, sells my father half the company, and that's how we got into pinball manufacturing. They actually didn't let my father into the factory for about a year. They weren't sure we were going to let this guy in, even though he's got part of the company. So he was only in the office. He was the sales. He did sales and what have you. But Harry was always, these guys were into flying, not Sam. Not Sam in the sense that Harry's chief engineer was a guy named Gordon Horlick. And Gordon trained, he was really a good pilot. Harry was a good pilot. This guy was really good. He trained bomber pilots in World War II. And actually, he joined the Army or the Air Force, whatever it was, got certified. They put him out as a private individual to train pilots. So what Harry and Gordon did at Williams is they had a link trainer. And a link trainer is one of those things you fly by instruments. You're under the hood. And they every afternoon, Gordon and Harry would spend the afternoon flying the link trainer. Not working, but flying the link trainer. My father flew it once, and he made a perfect landing, they tell me, except he was 200 feet underground. Other than that, absolutely perfect. But that's the kind of thing, that people were involved in. But Harry would go back and forth to California and work on designing games. Sam would run the business. And when Sam got involved, they were in a factory on Huron Street downtown. They had a multi-story factory. The first floor had jacks holding up the second floor. The third floor had jacks, holding up the fourth floor. And the fifth floor had jacks holding up the sixth floor. That's where they started out building. They moved to 4242 West Fillmore. It's on the central west side of Chicago. I didn't realize it was a dangerous neighborhood of any sort. I used to drive down there all the time, but they did steal the batteries out of the cop cars down there. The getaway car off a downtown jewel robbery came off of our parking lot. So, I mean, things went on. Right now, it's just a blighted area. Next time I do this, I'm going to go take a picture of the building because it's not very far from the cabinet maker from Churchill Cabinet, Chicago Gaming, which is in Cicero. This is right near Cicero. I used to drive down. I was very lucky in college. I had a TR4, a sports car. And the reason I had that car, I paid either $2,489 or $2,849. And I was in college from 63 to 67. That's 4 years. That's not, you know, like it took me extra years there. That's why I say 63. I graduated in June, and I graduated in June. So I did make it through regular. And any event, the reason I had that car is that the Seberg / Williams distributor in those days, I'm jumping years all over the place, was the, in California, in Los Angeles, had another business. He was the Midwest distributor for Jaguar and Triumph. In those days, the cars weren't brought in by Jaguar or then Triumph. They had a distributor who bought the cars from the English company and bought them here and resold them. They had a middleman. Any event, Sam and Harry were back and forth at the factory. Harry was back and forth. Sam was there a lot. I hung around. I saw this business. I learned it. I hung around it, all the time. With my father, with other business people, I would listen. I'd go down to the factory. Years later, when I was working there, they told me that I had gone one Saturday, and I was just playing in the switchblades, the old electromechanical switches with the phosphorus bronze blades, and we used to make our own switches. They'd stack them, and the machine would press them, with a Bakelite in between. So, I didn't realize there were different blades. I guess I had mixed them all up. That's wreaked havoc. I had all the little posts and the what have you, the pop bumpers in my desk drawer at where I studied, and that's the type of stuff that I played with instead of studying. I had all the men from the men running unit in a baseball game. They were cardboard on little metal things, so I could have my own baseball teams down there. And I had a pet rabbit who lived in a back box, because that's what we used for if we made a rabbit cage. The back where the wires come through, the bottom was where the door was. Chicken wire on the top. The back was on the, that was the rabbit's cage, and it had all that. Harry, on the other hand, he was, he would come and go, and he was like a second father. He would take me places. Some of you may know that he was into making games about trains, and he made these train games. Next time I'll get pictures of those. I found a briefcase full of Harry pictures, so I'm beginning to know to see all these old pictures. But in any event, I would hang around with Sam, and I'd hang around with Harry. The two of them, one time Harry would bring a drawing. He brings a drawing of a playfield in. Now, in those days, playfields were drawn not on a computer, on a drafting board, with pencils, drafting tools, erasers. And I'm laying on the floor with Sam and Harry, and they got the drawing out there, and they're looking at it, laying on the floor next to it. I lay down, but I'm not going to. Sam said, "It's great, but, upper corner," this is much later, I could drive by then, I'm 16, 17, "upper right, in upper left corner, you ought to try this, this, and this." So we have dinner, I take Harry back to the hotel, I bring him into work the next morning, and he's got a drawing, just like Sam wanted. There's no way he could have done that in the hotel. He didn't have a drafting table. He didn't have any of the tools. So obviously, he knew what Sam would object to. He put something in Sam would object to, so he wouldn't look at all the other stuff, and had the second drawing all ready to go. And that's one of the things you did working with him. But again, from a little kid, I was around. That's an embarrassing picture, but that's my father, and I think me. Could be my brother, but I don't think so. I think that one's me. So we were, I was around them all this time. Now, as I said, Harry and Sam were, Harry had started his own company, and Harry and Sam then were joined together. What happened to Durant? Lynn Durant. He was Harry's original partner in the earlier company. Well, Lynn had a company, United Manufacturing. And in 1949, Lynn invented the shuffle alley, the puck bowler. You know, right now, the last ones we saw had pins that come up, but this is, they didn't have pins. It just scored on light in the back box. He invented the puck bowler in 49. It was very popular, and he was making 525 of them a day. And these were full-size games. They were, you know, bigger than that. They were big games, and 525 of them a day. They cost him $125 fixed cost, you know, out-of-pocket cost to make. Yeah, he had overhead and all that, but $125, and he was selling them for $225. So that's $100 times 525 games a day, or 52,500 a day, $250,000 plus a week before paying the small salaries that existed at the time. So he was doing pretty well. Well enough that he had built an apartment. Two-bedroom apartment with a ballroom upstairs on the top of the factory. He could walk across a plank thing across it and go into the garage, down to the garage where his car was, you know, living there. He spent a lot of time down in the nightclub areas. He would give away Cadillacs to women. Or there was a guy at the Chez Paris was a big nightclub in Chicago. My mother used to take me, and I'd sleep under the table when she'd go hear Tony Bennett. I mean, I was little, so I wasn't my size sleeping under the table. I was little sleeping under the table. Well, apparently they all went there. There was a guy there whose car dealer wasn't doing so well. So, you know, Lynn said, fine, I'll take 50. And he bought 50 Fords from him, and that type of thing. Lynn also, he died broke because he had also funded some uranium expeditions. And so he, you know, he died without anything. He went through all the money. But, you know, he lived well. He lived big. The factory was the 3401 North California factory. That was United. And in 1964, Williams bought that factory. And when we went in there, and again, I was still in school, but we went in there and there'd be like butcher paper funneling water into a barrel here, and butcher paper funneling water into a barrel here. They had come up, not they, the architects had come up with this plan, nothing to do with pinball, but I find it interesting, where the gutters, the drain, it's a flat roof, and the drain, all the drains, the overflows to the gutters, was 2 inches above the roof, so that it would hold water, the theory being that it would keep the building cooler in the summer by having this insulation of water up there. The flaw to that, if any of you have had factory buildings, you know that you really don't want to walk on the tar roof and what have you, because if you walk here, there's a hole there, you know, and then the water is going to move. And that's what happens. By walking around, you create holes. So the whole thing was a disaster in that respect. But Harry had a nice life. He did all right. Back to Harry and Lynn had a nice life. He died broke. Harry didn't die broke. In 1959, Williams bought Harry's stock, which meant Sam bought Harry out. So now it was all Sam's business. Harry continued with us. He was always with us. He always worked with us in designing games. He was always there. Well, that was after a stint. He first became a distributor for a private jet. A French company, Marine Saulnier, made little private four-seat jets, and he decided he was going to be the distributor for it, and he was trying to sell these jet planes to people. Sales wasn't a strong suit to start with, but he also realized it didn't have any coin slots, so he gave up the planes and went back to designing games. That's how he describes it in any event. I started working there when I was 16 in the summers, and I started in the stock room, in a pinball machine. today is 3,500 different parts, a half a mile of wire. That'll be simplified with new electronics when, next year, the year after. But it's, you know, it's a complex thing. Sam started me there because the pinball company is first and foremost, it's not a design company, it's a manufacturing company. Ford is not a design company, it's a manufacturing company. It designs cars that it can manufacture. Ferrari is not a design company, it's a manufacturing company. It designs cars it can manufacture. First and foremost, we are a manufacturing company. If we can't manufacture efficiently, then we won't be there to design more games. I don't know, any of you here in manufacturing at all? Not something we see a lot of. I got a couple over here, You know that, you know, material control, if you don't run the business like a business, if you don't make any money and say it's just an art form, then you don't exist to design the next game. Steve Jobs said, art is shipping. You have to complete the product and get it out the door. And you design something somebody wants, but if you just design it, hey, here's a great game, you know, but nobody's ever going to get to play it, or one person is, or whatever. It's a manufacturing business. We're very patriotic manufacturers. We export half of our product, and we make them in Chicago area. So we're not making them offshore, but we are manufacturing, and we have to understand all of that. I was started in the stockroom. That's where he started me. It went great. I learned a lot. I learned not to put up a sign in Sam Stern's factory that said Sammy's Sweatshop. It was unair-conditioned and it was summer, so it was, you know, that created a lot of movement around the factory, a lot of panic and everything. That got people going. But, you know, going back, and I've said this before, and, you know, again, many of you have heard me talk before, and some of this is repetitious to you. The most important thing that the engineering department does is not design the game. It's create the bill of material, the parts list of that 3,500 parts that are in a game. Everything is run by an MRP, a material requirement and planning program. It's just a big adding machine that explodes what parts. I'm going to build 1,000 games. I need 2,000 flippers, because or 3,000 if it's a three-flipper game. It's just going to explode it. Now, Eddie Spears, who's in charge of our purchasing and started in the stockroom at Bally, notice I said stockroom again, it's material control. That's what this is all about. If you have too many parts left over at the end, you lose money. What are you going to do with them? You don't have enough parts to build the game, you lose money, you have to send everybody home, and you lose time. You never make up the day. If you don't ship it today, you say, well, I'll ship it tomorrow. No, that was the game you're shipping tomorrow is what you're supposed to sell tomorrow. I need to ship today so I can get a reorder to sell it tomorrow. It's manufacturing. It's what, you know, it is a serious business. And, you know, so if the design department leaves off the right flipper, a flipper bat, Eddie Spears, he's going to notice that. There's not enough flipper bats. If they leave off a ball guide, the orbit flat rail or something like that, he's not going to notice that. And we're going to have $2 million worth of parts coming in that we can't build anything with. So, okay, we'll get you that flat rail. It's normally a six, seven-week lead time. No problem. I'll get it to you in 3 weeks. So you shut down for 3 weeks. Material control is the most important thing, you know, in manufacturing. That's what we're doing. We are manufacturers. In this whole time frame that I'm talking about, Ray Maloney, again, a few people I'll keep mentioning. Ray Maloney, he passes away, head of Bally, so they got to do something with Bally. They got to sell it. Well, Bill O'Donnell is the head of sales. He didn't know what was going to happen to him. So Sam offered him a job to come sell at Williams, which he always remembered, but he was instead able to put together a group to buy Bally. Bally was the head of sales. By the way, Bill started where at Bally? He started in the stockroom, and he was the head of big Bally manufacturing when there was king of slot machines and everything else, but he started in the stockroom. That's where you learn a business. I also, when I worked in the summers, I worked in the accounting department. the language of business is numbers. It's accounting. My undergraduate degree, I have a BBA in accounting. That's my undergraduate degree. I'm a lawyer, but my in practice for all of 2 years, which makes me not much of a lawyer. But I'm still licensed. I have not been disbarred. People say, you used to be a lawyer. I say, no, no, I am a lawyer. I pay $275 a year for my license, and I'm still licensed. I may give it up next year because Illinois put in this thing called continuing education, where you have to study, you know, restudy. Well, I got to tell you, I'm not so good at studying right now. You can get these courses on disk. You put it, you know, you take the, you know, you just play it on the disc and you listen to it. I'm not going to tell you I never fell asleep during one of those, but I have listened to enough to be licensed. Any event, I worked in the accounting, and again, accounting, numbers, it's a language of business. If you can't run a business, how many of you are in business? How many are entrepreneurs or business working for another company? What do you guys all do? You know? What do you do for a living? Say, doctors, lawyers, candlestick makers?
Play pinball.
Well, good. I'm all for that. Well, my kids are out of college, but I still am all for that. You don't have a business plan. You don't know how much money you need. You don't know what the game's going to cost you. How do you know if you can afford to bake it? How do you know what you sell it for? How do you know how much money you need to buy the parts? It's all accounting. It's numbers. It's what it is. Now, so, you know, I worked in accounting, I worked in the stock room, I learned the business. I used to work, one summer, of course, Sam and I used to fight a little bit about, as fathers and sons do, when they work together. We never talk about Midas Muffler, Sam and I, because they turned the business over to the son, and then the father didn't like what he was doing, so he threw the son out. So we didn't want to talk about Midas, we never did that. Watch out, guys, watch out. Any event, so one day Sam and I must have had a fight, and I either quit or he fired me. I tend to think that he fired me. And so I'm home from school, and I'm in bed, and my mother wakes me up at 7 o'clock. And mother, is that the next picture? Mother. Okay, I blew it. Wrong, now it's doing something else. There it is, that's the only picture I had nearby of my mother and my father on some boat. We like boats. Boats are nice. That wasn't theirs. Any event, so my mother comes in and she says, it's 7 o'clock, time to get up and go to work. And I say, I don't have to. Why not? Sam fired me. And she said, well, I just rehired you. Get your ass out of bed and go to work. And apparently she had some words with him, and I was able to go to work. But anyway, I was around this thing all this time. I've learned, when we look at, you look at other professions, other businesses, you know, some doctors' sons become doctors, their sons become doctors, presidents' sons become presidents, presidential candidates' sons become presidential candidates, actors' sons become actors, pinball manufacturers' sons become pinball manufacturers. And, you know, you're around it. You learn it. It's something that you do, you understand, you know, and you grow up with, you have an understanding of it. Sam bought Harry out in 59. In the early 60s, he had an opportunity to sell the company, and he sold it. He's from Philadelphia. He sold it to Sunrite Drugs, a public drug company. I think they were public in Philadelphia. Of course, their business was worse than the game business, which is up and down, and the company almost ceased to exist. He bought it back from them, and I know it must have been a very trying time because I know our life changed for a little while, and it wasn't bad. I mean, I had a nice childhood or young, college age hood and whatever it was, collegehood. So he had the company back. In 1964, he had another opportunity to sell it, and this time to Seabird, a public company, a coin machine company. Having had the ups and downs, he did sell it to them in 64 and stayed with them for years, which I'll come back to. Didn't ask me. I was 64. I was in college, and didn't ask me what I wanted to do in my life. Did I want to go in this business, which I did. But, you know, he had to take care of what was going on. Now, in 64, he was, you know, young man. He was, he would have been 52. That's young to me because I'm 67 right now. But, you know, I took that lesson that he didn't ask me, and some years ago I said to my two daughters, I have a 31-year-old daughter and a 25-year-old daughter, so this was 3-4 years ago, and I said, look, kids, I said, Aaron, the older one, we're going to have a succession plan for this business. Are you interested in being in the pinball business? And she says, no, you should find something else to do, sell the slug, whatever. And I said to Lindsay, the one who's now 25, are you interested in being in the pinball business? Oh, I think we should keep it. No, honey, the question was not should we keep it. The question was, do you want to spend the rest of your life making pinball machines? At which point she said something like, sell the slug. Because she, you know, didn't want to do that. Now, the fact of the matter is that, huh? Adopt you, got it. The fact of the matter, I would have the same problem with you that I would have with my daughter, who now says, oh, yeah, I am interested. I said, well, it's too late, honey. I'm 67. You're 25. By the time you're 35, you may know something. You may not. You may know something. But I don't have 10 years to teach you. And that's the fact of it. The reason that I know anything about this business, and I keep coming back to the same theme, stockroom, accounting, numbers, is that I've been around it all this time. Now, they teach in business school, and I said this to somebody earlier. I hope I didn't already say it to you. And again, my undergraduate degree is in business. They teach you in business school to be in love with business, not your business. If we look at Williams is a slot machine. It's a slot machine company now. It's really a jukebox company. What do I mean, a jukebox company? Seberg, the jukebox company, bought Williams in 1964. The Nicastros run Williams, Seberg. Well, the jukeboxes were the mainstay of the coin machine business. Then they weren't. Then pinball was. So they converted the company into a pinball business that made jukeboxes instead of a jukebox business that made pinball. In fact, they spun Seberg out, and I bought Seberg out of bankruptcy, and I owned it for a while. Okay. They then changed it to a video game company, a coin-op video game company that happened to make pinball machines. And then a consumer video game company that made coin-op video and pinball machines. And then ultimately separated the video, and they went into slot machines, at which point they saw that pinball wasn't going to be viable, which I knew it wasn't. If you look at their 10-Ks, their SEC reports, wasn't going to be viable for them, even though they gave it, you know, the college try, a good shot at it. But the point is that they were good business people. They were in love with business, not their business. I'm a pinball guy. I'm in love with pinball and the pinball business. So at this point, it's too late to do something else anyways. So that's how, you know, that's how we stay with it. So also, I did go to law school, as I said. And Lou Nicastro, he was the boss. He originally came to Seberg from Inland Credit, which financed game operators. And I had gotten my BBA in accounting, undergraduate degree, a Bachelor of Business Administration. My parents thought I should have more education. I wanted to go to work. I said, no, you need more education. So they send me to see Lou Nicastro, this, you know, 40-year-old young guy who came there. And I go to see him, and he's going to talk me into getting more education. Not a chance. So while I'm sitting there, the phone rings, and he says, excuse me. He takes the phone, and he's talking to somebody. Yeah, I am looking for somebody, a young man like your age. What's your education? Oh, I was really looking for somebody with more education, maybe a master's in business. I'm sorry, click. So I went to law school. And many years later, I said to Lou, you tricked me, didn't you? Huh? The guy who called looking for a job was your secretary, Mary Yates, in the next room. Yeah. I went to law school because I got tricked into it. So... it was okay. It was okay. So meanwhile, Sam is still at Williams. And in 1969, he left for 1 year to go to Bally. Remember Bill O'Donnell? You know, There, his friend, Bill O'Donnell, who we offered a job to. He hires Sam as executive vice president in charge of pinball. Sam goes over there because he wasn't happy with what was going on at Williams. Well, he wasn't so happy over there either. And when Nicastro was restructuring the whole thing, Sam comes back to Williams. And from 70 to 76, we were there. I practiced law from 71 to 73. Sam wanted me to go straight, not be in the game business. You know, he thought he was the ultimate, pardon me, the ultimate Jewish father. He had his son the doctor, my brother, and his son the lawyer. What else could he ask for, you know? And my mother thought she'd gone to heaven, which actually at that point she had, but that's another question. I practiced law for a couple of years. I also, again, Sam started as a game operator. I owned, actually, with Lou Nicastro's secretary and her husband, they were my partners. Different secretary, not the one that tricked me. Different one. We owned Wise Fool's Pub, which was a hippie jazz and blues club. I call it that, a small jazz blues club in Chicago. And then I had part of a 1,000-seat nightclub. The point that I'm making is that games are in bars. My father started as an operator. I started, well, in the stock room, but also not as an operator other than the game that was in our place, but as a location owner. So I understand from the location owner's point of view. Now, you guys say, well, we're collectors. What does all this mean to us? Part of our business is game operators. Part of it is you guys. Part of it is just people who want games in their home. So that part is important. More than half of our games are operated. Maybe not in America, but throughout the world, more than half of the games that we sell are on location, are operated. Some of your friends are operating the fancy games here, the premiums and the LEs, in addition to the pros. Games were in bars. That's where we were largely. Harry had this game. He was designing this game, Hot Hand, that had this great big, it was a card game with a great big flipper about this big at the top, went in a circle, would knock the balls out of little holes, nodding, they know the game. And Harry said, oh, the kids are going to love this game. I said, Harry, that's great, but you're really not designing games for kids. Your job is to get people drunk and keep them drunk. And that's what we were. We were ancillary entertainment. And therefore, you don't want the most complex game. You want something that you know that could be understood. You know, we are assigned at work 15 minutes a day. You know, 15 minutes a day that we must play pinball. It's part of what we have to do in order. You know, the game is designed mostly. We need to percentage it, see how long it plays, how often different features are made, so forth. So each of us in the overhead group are assigned 15 minutes a day to play. I'm not a great player. I'm old and slow. So I represent the guy who's had 4 beer when I play. And we need that variety. Some of our people, we have Lyman Sheets. We had Keith there. These guys were too good. You know, they don't count. You got to knock them off, this whole thing. But some of the other people got pretty good, and I'm not sure that they weren't making as much money playing pinball outside of our place as they are, as we're paying them. But, you know, you have to think of the kind of places that we're going. The new locations that I'm seeing, and I think this is very important, it is to me, are locations that are barcades. They're bars that the 20-somethings are going to that have games in them. The one up, my daughter's living in Denver. I go to Vail a lot since 1978. I've had an apartment there when it was very affordable before it got too ritzy, which I don't like. I'd go somewhere else if I wasn't this old. But any event, I'm talking about for snowboarding, man. I'm talking for me to snowboard. So we're driving by this place called the One Up, and she says, "Oh, there's games in there." So turn around, you know. So we go in. And this is a 20-something bar near the ballpark. They're now opening, they just opened the 2-Up in the neighborhood she's moving to. The 1-Up has 42 1980s upright video, comprehensible video, and 3 skee-ball that last about 8 months. They get so much play. And 14 pinball machines. And they have a tournament the first Sunday of every month. But other than that, it's young people, it's casual players. In Chicago, the Emporium opened. It's got a half a dozen pinball machines and 35 of these old upright videos. Barcade in Brooklyn has only a video, and there are all these older video games. They have a place in Jersey City, and I think Barcade is Philadelphia somewhere, Pittsburgh somewhere. In Texas, there is Barcadia, and they're opening in New Orleans, I read. So, I mean, we know about Shorties. Most of you know about Shorties from this part of the country, which is, you know, a smaller version and really is more pinball-oriented. But still, a lot of his business on the weekends is casual players. And really, you know, it's an age-old problem of game design. I can't help myself but to go there. And that is that it's not just pinball, it's anything. How do we keep the core player and get the casual player to play? How do we make these games fun instead of threatening? And I go back, Harry said, and I got to go back to Harry. Harry said, and this is a late 70s article. And so Harry says, designers and manufacturers don't want to get so bogged down with the electronics that we forget what players want. It's a digress. That means memory drop targets, and we reset, and we can make the targets do special things. The games got so complex that we couldn't figure out what they were supposed to do, some of the rules. The casual player didn't get it. We haven't even really started with the potential of electronics, but the technology should not only augment ball action. We need more innovations in the play field, too. New electromechanical devices. Players want to see that silver ball moving around the playboard, to feel involved in the action of the game. The primary thing in pinball is the thrill of hitting the ball. And that's Harry. And that's, you know, 30 years ago. And that's really the same today. We need to broaden our market. We need to have casual players understanding what we're doing. And, you know, that's what we're trying to do. That's what Harry and Sam were trying to do when they continued to work together. At Williams, my title had business cards printed that specified exactly what I did. It said Gary Stern, boss's son. And I was the right hand that did stuff. I remember I was negotiating. It was unions in those days, so I was negotiating the union contract. It was me in front, 30-year-old punk kid, maybe. Behind me, the CFO and the personnel manager and all that, and I can tell you that every night I went and called counsel because counsel and we all talked every night, and so did the union guy talk with us. Harry Weaver was a union guy. He was a business agent. He, by the way, started in the Williams, working at Williams. He started in the stock room. Okay? He understood the business. He understood the people, and the business is people, no question about it. In fact, one time was embarrassing. We're negotiating, and he just got angry, and he just threw his stuff down and said, I should have left you in that box and shipped you out, because I was a little kid playing in a box, and he was sealing me up one Saturday, and he should have shipped me out. Makes it real easy to sort it all out. Left Williams in 76, as did my father. Steve Kaufman, who worked with us, he and I had KISS amusement machines, to keep it simple, stupid. We were selling slot machines. We had joined Williams to run the slot machine program. It wasn't a great success, but we had slot machines. Now it is, but different slot machine program. Canada had an interesting law. They legalized free play slot machines. And in French, it said something about free play machines, coin in a slot. And when they translated to English, it said something like free play slot machines. So for about 4 months, we were just having a field day selling credit-only slot machines into Montreal. It was great. Sam had retired. Let's see. That would have been 76, so he would have been 64. He was retired. And my sister-in-law, Barbara, she calls me one day, says, you got to get him a job. He's cleaned my closets twice this week. And Sam was a little anal. He was anal impulsive. I'm anal expulsive, which we won't describe. So we bought the assets. I was a bankruptcy lawyer. We bought the assets out of foreclosure, CDI, and that was, and we ran that till 84. Now, at that time, pinball was changing. You'll see in the tour out there the same game, solid state, and electromechanical. It was changing to electromechanical. Well, we didn't have the solid state. We didn't have a solid state system. So we figured, okay, let's reverse engineer something. We're going to reverse engineer the Bally system. We had to have a Bally machine to do that with. So Bill O'Donnell, remember Bill O'Donnell? He had a machine sent from the pinball factory to the stockroom on the dock, the loading dock on Bally, a mile away from us on Belmont. We picked it up, and we used that machine to reverse engineer. And he also said, if you have any trouble, call me so that we can help this get done. Now, I think it was good for his business because it meant there were two games, two manufacturers' games had the same electronic system. His son, Billy, who was friendly with, didn't think that was such a good thing. But, and Sam was saying, oh, this is never going to work. We're going to fail. You get a little older like I am, you become a little more conservative. But that's what we did. We reverse engineered the Bally system, which means reverse engineered the Bally system. It means I think we copied it. There's innovative engineering and creative copying. Some things are protected and some things are not. When we started Dade East Pinball, we reverse engineered the Williams system. Even that takes a long time. We had IT, Richard Ditton was the one who did our programming from scratch. No copying of their program. That would be a violation of their copyright protection. IT is incredible technology. So those days, we took the game off the back of my convertible and carried it into their house. That's where they were working from, the Dittons. And they were free radical technology. And I said, you guys are neither free nor radicals. You're not a bunch of hippies, and we're paying you. But that's, I guess, a physics term, which I didn't know. And that took time. When we went, we went from our White Star system to our SAM system. Now, SAM of White Star is Cameco named it. That's our White Star board system. And White Star means stern in German. So White Star. Got it? White Star. Yeah, okay, there you go. And it was a good solid system, but we went to the SAM system, which is either for Sam Stern, or I like to think it stands for sand and mirrors, smoke and mirrors, because there's no way that a bunch of sand can do what chips do. So it's got to be smoke and mirrors. But it took 2 years for Lyman to get that thing programmed, for us to design and get it programmed. It all takes a lot longer than we would want it to do. But back to Stern Electronics. We're there, and our first game, now we got a solid-state system, and our first game is pinball. But in those days, you didn't have EEPROMs. You had mass ROMs. Now, you remember Sam and Harry on the floor with those drawings that Sam said, changes one part, and Harry already knew what to do and had it. Well, there was no way that we were going to get another set of masked ROMs for, I guess, Stingray was the next game. So I said, okay, we'll double them up. We'll have, if there's a light A and 500 points, we'll stack those switches, and this rollover will light A and give you 500 points. Sam was not very receptive to that. But what I did is I put a flipper in the middle of the play field. So that, if you were coming straight off the flippers, you would hit this flipper and it would hit the ball somewhere. Sam says, you can't do that. That's ridiculous. So we didn't do that, but we got to do the program the way Harry would have tricked him into doing it. Same type of thing. And that's how we were able to do it. Any event, you all know we ran Stern for a long time. 6-8 years. We ran it up the pole and down the pole. Game business had changed considerably. Pinball wasn't there. We had some good video games, but we had some great video games. But in fact, I was at the Pinball Extreme, and there's none of our video games. Maybe one was there. And why are there none of the Stern video games? And then it came to me. We made video games in fantastic, all plywood, no MDF cabinets. They were light, they were easy to move, and they held together. And it was the best conversion cabinet to convert video games to You know, if you had a Dr. Do or Mr. Do, you put it in our cabinet. So all of our games got converted into something else. After Stern, I proved that the economics of conversion pinball wasn't any good. The economics didn't work, and that's when I did Gamatron with Steve Kirk, great pinball designer who did Stars, Nine Ball, and Meteor, two of which are out here. Nine Ball he did because he wanted to show us that the electronic system was brain dead. It wouldn't do enough stuff. So that's what we did there. It's the same time as High Speed came out, and why would you buy our kit and when you could trade your game in and buy a new High Speed? And economics just made more sense rather than putting the labor into a kit conversion game that didn't have ramps and wasn't going to be any good. In 86, I put together a business plan. We started Data East Pinball. That's why we're here now. I sold it from Data East to Sega, which was a 20% shareholder of Data East in 94. 99, we bought it from Sega. It really wasn't particularly interesting to Sega in that Japanese companies typically want a business that's buying something from Japan, a way to transfer the profit back to Japan, even at a higher tax rate. And we didn't buy anything from Japan. Actually, we sold them some games. And plus, they're a billion-dollar-plus company, and you know our little business wasn't going to be meaningful. I knew that Williams was going to be, and I told Sega, Williams is going to get out of the pinball business. If you look at the 10Ks, you could see what it cost to design and develop the Pinball 2000, which was a great engineering effort, but they needed to sell about 20,000 machines a year to break even, and the market was significantly less than that. It wasn't going to develop to that. Nicastro went over to Europe, came back and shut it down after he came to the same conclusion that I knew he would. Remember, Nicastros are in love with business, not their business. They weren't in love. They put a lot of money behind pinball and let these guys try something, but they weren't in love with it. They had to, you know, protect the business overall. So in 2009, I brought in a partner, not only because of my age, but also because we had to survive the Lehman Brothers recession. We stripped the business down. We made it through, and we're rebuilding it now. And you all know that we've added a lot of great people. Most recently would be Greg Ferris, and you know that Steve's with us, and George is with us, and Lyman's with us, and many other young people, young guys are with us that are doing great. We need to continue this business. We're dedicated to continuing it. And you say, well, why? You know, just so I can sell it and give my kids some money? That'd be nice, but you know, that's another question. You know, it's not like I get Social Security. I don't need to, you know, I don't need to do this. It's because we all love what we're doing. You know, one follows in one father's footsteps. One has a legacy, a family legacy, to continue. And we employ a lot of people, and we have to protect the employment of those people. You need that trained workforce, and these people, most of them have been with us a long time. Even the people who are temps come back and go. You know, again, for me, it's very important that we continue to make pinball, and the pinball continues to exist. The pinball's on the street so that it continues to exist for you guys to be collectors. You know, if we're not doing this and making 5,000 to 8,000 pinball machines a year, you're not going to have any new games to become old games, to either buy new or to buy old, because there won't be any more. And they will all go to pinball heaven somewhere. We have to keep doing this. Yeah, Gene does a good job, I guess. I'm sure he does, of making an old game once in a while. Wayne in Australia does not do a good job. Jack is working on his game. But as far and then we got, you know, like Dennis and Greg with Wodinelli, which is great stuff. J-Pop's working on some stuff. And, you know, other people, other of you are, you know, collector stuff, great. If we don't have commercial pinball, it will not be continue either having games for you to buy. You know, okay, yeah, you know, how many of Gene's games used are you going to get, and they're going to be very expensive. You know, we have to have commercial pinball for that and for it to be topical, for it to be something current, something to want. I've done this before. You've heard my McMansion story. You drive up to the McMansion. It's got four garage doors. One opens up, and it's, you know, rich people. It's got Dad's Mercedes. The next one opens up. It's got Mom's Lexus SUV. The third one has the kids' Jeep Wrangler. And the fourth one, of course, has a horse and buggy because the dad collects horse and buggies. No, nobody collects horse and buggies. It's got a bathtub Porsche in it or something, you know, a 356 or whatever. They collect cars because they're topical, they're current. And if we don't keep pinball current, then you or your kids, you'll be around. They won't be around long enough to see it go away. Your kids will. We need pinball to continue. I need it to continue for my family heritage, even though my children aren't going into this. It's Stern Pinball. Stern's on the door, and we want to continue making pinball for you all and for the rest of the world. So with that, I didn't talk a whole bunch about what we're doing because I've done that every other time. I talked about where I came from. But we've got time, and I'll answer any questions we can think of. Anybody got any questions, or are we?
You glossed over real quick a couple lines I'm always curious about. Chicago Coin acquisition and advertising posters.
Advertising posters, okay. Tommy Grant.
Well, just real quick. When you bought the Chicago Coin, your father bought it.
No.
You bought it.
Yes. No. What happened? Sam was 64. He was retired, okay? He knew the bankers who were the lenders to Chicago Coin. Chicago Dynamic Industries. They were being paid. It was not going to come out. I was a bankruptcy and banking lawyer. Okay, so we put together a deal where they financed us, and they bought. There was an auction. The banks bid in their debt, $3 million or whatever it was, and they financed us $3 million. We put in hundreds of thousands of dollars. And let me tell you, in 86, '76, that was not chump change. We put in money, and Sam was not a shareholder. We had some outside shareholders who knew the bank also. We had Marty Bromley was a shareholder, who is the founder of Sega. And my brother and myself, we were the shareholders. Now, there's some estate planning there. I was the president. My father was the vice president. He worked half days. But, you know, it's something about working with your father, and I'm going to do this. It's a wonderful thing if it works. And ours worked. And I thought, how lucky was I? You know, I got to work with my father. I knew weaknesses nobody else knew. Sorry, guys. I knew strengths nobody else knew. I would go, you know, Bill O'Donnell, Bally. So I go with the two of them drinking. Now, these old guys, you know, mid-60s and 60 years old, and the kids drinking with them, and they normally go to the pump room, where it's a big shot place at the time. Maybe a couple places in the pump room. They would drink me under the table. Once I put my father to bed, it was great. Absolutely great. But, you know, I'd say, okay, he would wake me up every morning. He would call. He'd get up at 6. When you get older, you get up, you know, earlier. You just sleep less. You shouldn't. He'd get up at 6 and call me at 7 to wake me up. But he couldn't call to wake me up. He had to call. I had this idea. So I called. You know, he's calling me with an idea. And some of them were really harebrained. Some of them were great. Every morning I woke up to a new idea. You know, I knew what was going on. And if one of my friends called me at 3 in the morning, I answered the phone like I'd been awake for 2 hours, just like I answered the phone when my father called. He shouldn't know he's waking me up, and I shouldn't know that he's calling to wake me up. Okay. How lucky was I to really know him like that? And now I realize I was lucky, but how lucky was he that he kept part of the family unit together. Every day we were together. 4 hours, 6 hours, no, I don't know. Every day we're together. My kids don't work with me. One's in California, one's in Denver, movie business, internet or marketing business. we snowboard. We have something in common. Yeah. But to have had the opportunity to have me there, part of his, one of his two children, it's just, he was really lucky. And I really feel good for him that he was, that he had that. And I'm digressing way the hell off pinball machines, but I did. Your other question was about ad posters.
Well, yeah, you turned me on, introduced me to Tom Grant.
Tommy, yeah.
And I've just always been curious as to how that evolved over the years to the point where I could say we're printing four color on glass.
And Tommy's involved with our back glass printing, with the four color printing on glass, the mirroring and the four color.
I guess that's what I'm asking. Is he the one that I know that
he gets? Let me see what I can do here. A tag, ad posters did the silk screening for everybody, and they had a small factory, a multi-story factory over on Black Hawk, not far from the Seaberg factory, which was on Weed Street. Just off North Avenue, and I remember going to that factory once, and we went out in the factory. It was closed. We went out in the factory. I've never been so stoned before in my life. It was glue sniffing. I mean, it was just paint. I was just absolutely stoned. Tommy, how do you do this? I'm fine. I'm in the office. The workers, But in those days, you don't care so much about workers, I guess. We didn't have OSHA like now. But, I was stoned. Then they moved over on Diversey. And Tommy, like the rest of us, had ups and downs, and he grew too much and then didn't grow enough and, so forth. He was our silk screener for years at TAG, which is Thomas A. Grant Company or something advertising graphics, So he, for years. Now he's, he's, I guess, semi-retired, but he still does. He's a few years older than me. He still does, and he had a stroke, so he's not quite as well. He still does some of our work, not for our normal back glasses or our silk screening or what have you, on the play fields and the cabinets, of course, are decals. But he gets the mirroring done. He's still in the glass business. He's actually in the glass business. So he gets the mirroring done, and then it goes over with him to Nelson Graphics, where we do the machine silk screening. It's silk screened with a machine there. So he's involved to that respect. Yes, sir.
Thanks. When you started CERN Electronics, how long was it after you started the company that Harry Williams came to work with you, and how did that come about?
How long after we started CERN Electronics did Harry Williams come to work for us? A minute or two. Now, Harry's been with us. Harry's always been with us. Harry was always. He died a little bit before my father. But Harry, he was always with us. Always. Yes, sir.
If you hadn't bought Chicago Coins bankruptcy, would anybody?
No, I doubt it.
Right, and then so if that hadn't happened, would you be in the pinball business then?
Probably. First of all, the cost of entry, it was so much. Harry used to say, and I keep talking about Harry, but, Harry is, he's the milestone, okay? Harry used to say that, I could do everything. I come up with an idea, I draw it, I make a sample, I wire it myself, put some relays in it, I play it and so forth. The games are, you see the wood, the wood legs out here, they're simpler games, so forth. He could do everything himself. In 76, 77, when we went solid state, he couldn't anymore. He couldn't do the software. He couldn't design the electronics, the PCBs. It wasn't just wiring in some circuit from relays and step-up units. It required more different people doing different tasks. And the games become more complicated. Listen, a Mustang today, and I have one out here rented, is a very nice car. Harry had a 65, and I've driven it. I drove it in those days. And it's, it's not the same car, just like the pinball machine isn't the same pinball. Heck, it had roll-up windows. Try and sell a car with roll-up windows today. It's just not the same. Not the same. The world has changed. The technology has changed. But the other thing that's changed is the competition. And I don't mean competition from other pinball people. I don't even mean competition from video games or anything else. I mean competition of all kinds of entertainment. You know, think about it. There was no internet. There was no rental. There was no on demand. There was no rental of movies. There was no. Listen, the poor touchscreen guys, Merritt and so forth, who make touchscreen games for bars. Who needs to put a quarter in a touchscreen game when you got this in your pocket? It's a game machine. Well, there's so many other entertainments available today that wasn't available then. So the world's changed, and it changes. I'd make pinball machines. Yes, sir.
So if your daughters are interested in going into the business, you want to adopt this gentleman. Without making any sort of announcements or anything, I mean, what's the future?
You know, again, in 2009, Dave Peterson joined. We're building a company that will have depth of management. You know, it's an entrepreneurial company right now, which means I did everything. I don't anymore. You want it to exist. You know, you limit yourself as a, you know, in this type of business as an entrepreneurial company where everything had to be decided by ultimately by me. So we're delegating and giving people responsibility. Now, in 2009, 2008, we cut out all middle management to survive the Lehman Brothers recession. Now we build it back up, again, with George and with other designers and so forth. You know, I mean, we had to lay Steve off. Steve's back, you know, that type of thing. You all know that story. And so we're building a great company, and we're adding some young people. Wason and Mike Kisovac are programming games. Borgi is not an old man. He's not like me. You know, he's 40s, I guess. So, you know, we're putting something intact there so that it will continue. Dave is, you know, Dave is what he calls himself a boutique venture capitalist. So, you know, he and his group put some money in, but they put in management. They're involved in it. And he looked at us and he said, okay, is this Buggy Whips or is this Harley? He worked, you know, he made his money with Morgan Stanley. He's a young 50s. Made his money with Morgan Stanley, young mid-50s, and worked on Harley. And like Harley, we have a core of dedicated enthusiasts. Maybe you like our games, maybe not, but you're dedicated to pinball and you're enthusiasts. Just like the Harley people, and they're dedicated to Harley, and I have one, of course, because we've made the Harley pinball machine, and I went to this, everything was so cool when you went to the dealer show. I said, oh, I got to get one of those. So I don't want to tell you I made a trade, but so any event, you know, we have a future, and we have a plan, and we have a plan to grow this business from what it is now to. I don't know if I'm supposed to say the number, but it's big, and it's big plans, and it's as a pinball business. The core business is pinball, 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 and that's what we are, and that's what we want to be. And, you know, right now it's... Thank you.
Gary, are you continuing to do licensed games? Is that your main goal now from now on?
Yeah. And you know, people, I always answer this one, I'm always asked, and sometimes I start to think different. But let's use an example. You know, I mean, licensing does a number of things for us. One is that, you know, it puts us in touch with other creative people, not just in our pinball ivory tower. We're trying to appeal not just to you all, but to a broad group of people. We know if we make a stuffed animal and make it in the shape of a mouse, we're not going to sell any unless we pay Walt. And that's just the nature of the world. Lucas created the licensing business with Star Wars. And after the first Star Wars, he was owed a lot of money. He went to Ladd, who was the head of the studio, and said, well, why don't you just give me the ancillary rights? And he said, well, let me... how much licensing would... Okay, fine. That was $1 billion ago. So it does that. It also does something very important. It gives the designers, you know, some place to design. Jurassic Park had a ball-eating dinosaur because Crichton was smart enough to know that dinosaurs were cool. You know, Joe designed a great game for Game Plan, Joe Chemical, that they never built, Loch Ness Monster. And the only thing I would have done different is instead of a Loch Ness Monster under the clear glass, I would have put a dinosaur under it, that type of thing. Because dinosaurs were hot in those days. But the other thing it does is when I call the French and I say, I got AC/DC, they say, here's $400,000. when I say I got a rock and roll smorgasbord game, they say, send me two, I'll test it for 8 weeks and let you know. Guys, it's the real world. You go in, go into a Lego store. Legos are hot, okay? Huh? Legoland, go into, they have retail stores. Go into a retail store in the Water Tower in Chicago, and probably 60, 70% of the goods in there are licensed. Star Wars, Star whatever, you know, they're licensing. They got Legos. Why do they have to license? Because that's the real world, folks. Now, would I never do it? I've said never, but I don't know. Probably never. Let the next guy do it. That way, I'm going to invest $1 million of the company's money to design a game to find out that it wasn't, you know, whereas if it's a title, I'm going to sell it one way or another. Yes, sir.
Now, how do you go about, like, who picks the title? Like, you have a couple licenses, and how do you decide what designer is going to design that game?
There's a rotation with designers. You want the designers to be onto the title, involved in it. There's a marketing guy, my partner Dave, myself. I have to sell it, talk to a couple customers, that type of thing. You know, it's a joint decision. You can't tell somebody your creative juices will flow and you're going to design Niagara. You know, I don't want to design Niagara. Okay, well, what are you going to do? Yes, sir.
What makes you come up with the themes of the games, like Tron or Avatar?
It's just what, you know, we look at what's topical. We look at what's selling. Tron, you know, Tron was unusual. You guys wanted Tron, and the original Tron game was designed by George Gomez. Okay? So, you know, we look at what's going on, what movies are coming, what, go to licensing shows, talk to people we know, see what's going on.
Do hangover, I'd be here.
Yeah, would it? Well, let me ask you about that. First of all, we talked about it. It's not going to cut it in Europe. That's number one. But number two, remember, we're selling three markets, okay? We're selling you guys. We're selling operators to put in family entertainment centers. And we're selling, I say tongue-in-cheek, rich doctors and lawyers who have to tell their wives it's for the kid. Hangover doesn't make it. Doesn't make that, all of that stuff. Yes, sir.
Who's designing the next game?
Yes, sir. Next question. Yes.
I'm an operator. I've bought one or two of every game for the last 6 or 8 years, and I have a problem with the fact that all the themes seem to be male-orientated.
Yeah.
The female game I had that the girls would go to was Shrek.
Yeah.
And I've got a real problem with the whole front row being nothing but guys, and the girls are sitting off over to the side discussing current events. I think you're missing half the market.
We're missing half the public. I'm not sure it's half the market, but I agree with you. Your point is well taken. And Shrek actually, you know, did better than, I mean, it wasn't a bar game, but Shrek was unusual in that we had a very good game in Family Guy, but was not a good title for Europe, was not a good title for, you know, some other places, some people. Ray Tanzer was in charge of our design, mechanical engineering, and he said, I love it, but I won't take that home. Believe it or not, and that's the one TV show I can watch with my daughter, that and Cribs or something like that. But any event that they watch, I can't tell you. And, you know, how do you go to a licensor and say, well, I'm not going to give you your own game? Well, they didn't want to be in bars with Shrek, so we said, okay, we'll do that. But your point's well taken. It did very well in Europe for us. You're right. We need to find some. Yeah, I hear you. I hear what you're saying. I got it. But, you know, you're right in another sense, and that is that our home business, everything that comes in the home, you guys may be different. You know, with some of your wives will let you bring anything you want in there. But, pardon? Yeah, and that was, well, I'll come back to that one. That we made it twice, and the second one was not marketing smart. I have a friend in billiard business, and the guy comes in, they'll talk to him for 45 minutes. He comes in with his wife, they'll close him. Daddy's telling mommy it's for the kids, and Playboy doesn't work for that. Playboy doesn't work in bars because bartenders bar owners are afraid of the women. I knew we were in trouble with it when at a trade show, Gary Spencer, operator in Las Robles, middle of the state, he, you know, his girlfriend used to play all our pinball. She would not play Playboy. The world has changed. You know, that is this. I'll tell you my. Never mind. Well, and that wasn't a strong title, I have to tell you. I like the game. What else we got? Yes, sir.
So you mentioned, you know, there's a lot of people right now experimenting with pinball and technology, mm-hmm. and trying different things and whatnot. As far as Stern's concerned, where do you see Stern in like 5-10 years? Is pinball going to look the same?
You're going to see differences in the cabinet, the electronics. This is an outdated electronic system. You go to a car behind a car today, and all the taillights are LEDs. Now, our games, our LEs and premiums have LEDs, but all our games need LEDs. And instead of a cable like this, there's a small six-wire like your computer cable and a power cable going to semi-smart boards, a bus system. And you can't make this reliable or economically, you know, pretty soon. First of all, you know, I mean, we got to be more surface mount. Through-hole parts are history. They don't exist, and many of them that you can get will not be acceptable for Europe. You want me to wind this up or what? You want to ask a question? What do you want me to do? Okay. Well, I can stay for 2 hours, but you can't. So, yeah, there's going to be changes. Yeah. Oh, I like that. I also have a meeting downtown. Go ahead.
Hey, I appreciate you wanting to keep pinball out there and spread and everything. Don't you think it'd be smart to have a nice place to showcase your new pinball?
You know? I am thrilled. I'm absolutely thrilled that there are museums like yours, and there's been a couple other guys, as you know, who tried or even you guys are unique in that you make it work and all that. The guy in the East Coast tried for a while, and some other people try it here and there. And, you know, of course, usually when I come here, you're closed for this or something like that. But, you know, I understand what you're saying. We try and work with you all. If, you know, there's so many people with both shows and, you know, there's got to be a tournament, an IFPA tournament, sanctioned tournament, one or two a week. You know, going on. Yeah, the IFPA ranks 14,000 players in 30 countries right now. You know, and, I mean, yeah. So, you know, somebody wants us to send them some back glasses for giveaway or a trophy or this or that. We're
I'm just talking about us.
Okay, I got it. Greed. Greed is good. Any other questions before I got to get out? We get thrown out. Yes, sir.
Which Stern game did you make the most of?
That's not a fair question in this respect, and that is that in the mid-90s, 1993, we'd make, for a couple years, we would make 27,000 of a game. That's over. That's, again, too much other competition. So, let's see, Jurassic Park was 9,000. Star Trek, I think. Star Wars, I can't remember, but two of them were 10,000.
What about newer ones, like 2000 and up?
The last 15 years.
Yeah, we actually don't publish the numbers on it, and I don't know what it gives or doesn't give us.
But for historical, now that games are in production, can we eventually know, like, how many...
Yeah, I've been asked that today, as you know, and I'm going to consider that. Let me talk to my partners and marketing folks.
Where are you going to bring back Simpsons again?
Oh, man. Probably not, but I like
it.
No. Not because I don't know off the top of my head. I have a sheet somewhere. Anything else, or are we wrapped up here? All right, thank you. There's some, if anybody would like some advertising material, there's some brochures up here.